The Sunstone Theological Society presents Dirty Dancing, Mormons, and the Hula, recorded live at the 1988 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 17th through the 20th, 1988. We take you to the University Park Hotel in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
Mike, my name is Ann Kenny, and I'm pleased to be the chair for this session this morning. Our guest speaker is James Whitehurst. He is currently an instructor at Illinois Wesleyan University, professor there. And to give you a little bit about his background, he has his Bachelor's of Art and Master's in Philosophy from Northwestern University. He has his Bachelor of Divinity and Philosophy. He got his PhD in Philosophy of History. He's been 30 years at Illinois Wesleyan and has a very interesting sidelines that he likes to get involved with. He's a professional magician on the side, which I don't know if that has anything to do with Dirty Dancing, but it may. He has two grown children. One is studying in philosophy. Is he still studying or teaching at NYC?
He's in photography. Not teaching any longer.
Okay. And a daughter at Berkeley, at the library system there. To give you an idea of some of his publications, these are very interesting and diverse titles. Mainstreaming the Black Muslims, Zoroastrians Established the U.S. Center, Hawaii's Domestication of Shinto Inside a Mormon Temple, Mormonism, the History of a New Religious Tradition, AIDS, the New Leprosy, and then different papers, Death Ceremonies, Insight into Life, A Comparison of Chinese and Zoroastrian Funeral Practices, Mormonism, Mystery Religions, and Masonry, and the Zoroastrian Connection, Mormon Theology's Persian Roots. So it'll be my pleasure to introduce James Whitehurst, but before I do, I just realized I need to introduce also our commenter, who is Dale Blair, and he is filling in very graciously at the last moment. His wife, Kathleen, was going to comment, but she needs to be with her mother, who is in surgery this morning. His background is that he has a bachelor's in linguistics and history at BYU. He's currently a master's student in folklore and American studies at Utah State University and is currently teaching English as a second language at Westminster College. So now I'll turn the time over to Dr. Whitehurst, and we'll look forward to hearing from him. Thank you.
Thank you, Anne. I don't know if your program had this little smudge right by the word paper, did it? Whether that was the printer's comic relief right by the word dirty and dancing. My paper was not intended for an audience like this. I did it with a non-Mormon audience in mind, planning to send it on to one of the periodicals or journals in the field of religion. And so there will be some things in here, obviously, that may seem a little strange to you, in other words, explaining what Mormonism is. I did get it accepted for the Journal of American Culture, and it'll appear in that journal next year. So if I talk about, you know, what Mormons are and what they do, you can just assume that's part of my addressing the general audience at these points. I had originally hoped to have a panel discussion on this topic, and I sent the paper to a few friends in Utah and elsewhere and got a few comments, and some of them were negative. Negative enough to get, I thought, perhaps some fireworks going on the topic. I thought that might be fun. The panel didn't work out, and evidently the Sunstone planners needed something to fill a slot, so here I am, and I'll just read the paper as it is. I do have copies, and I have two minds on this. Do you people like to have a paper in your hand, or do you prefer to have it later? All right. You prefer just to listen to me, and then... okay, it'll be here, and pick up a copy if you'd like as you go out. As a college-age youth minister in a Chicago church nearly 50 years ago, I was reprimanded for allowing young people to dance in the church parlor. "The devil approaches the heart through the toes," admonished my superior. A pastorate or two later, an elder put it even more succinctly, "Dancing is nothing but vertical sex." Today we smile at people who hold these views and consider them narrow-minded. According to popular stereotypes, Mormons would seem to fit this provincial model. They are the squarest of the square. They don't smoke or indulge even in caffeinated beverages. Chastity is a sprint for temple marriages. Profanity is rigidly proscribed. Even excessive sideburns are off-limits at Brigham Young University campus. Legend has it that an airline stewardess once announced, "We have just arrived in Salt Lake City. Please set your watches back 30 years. But Mormons are surprisingly with it when it comes to dancing. Joseph shocked his contemporaries by countering the stereotypes of the gloomy prophet, and Brigham Young encouraged most types of dancing. In the trek to Utah, it was common for a fiddler to strike up a tune at nightfall so that pioneers could dance away their weariness. When they arrived in the Great Salt Lake, dance halls were some of the first public buildings under construction, long before work was begun on the temple. Saints kicked up their heels with lively square and line dances, while mainstream Protestants continued to shun dance as the work of the devil. Acceptance of dance has paid handsome dividends for Mormons, who are currently able to attract and hold their youth in ways which other groups might well emulate. Most LDS buildings have a cultural hall that is used each week for teenage dances and dramatic activities. And by the time youth enroll in a university, many of them bring talents and skills that can be tapped for dance troupes such as the Ballroom Dance Company, the Young Ambassadors, or the American Folk Dance Company, all at Brigham Young University, where the Department of Dance is bigger and more varied than almost any university in the world. Such openness to dance and theater has provided an unheralded evangelical and public relations tool, creating much goodwill for this harassed religion. LDS troops, dance troops, have opened doors for saints even in communist lands, such as the People's Republic of China and Poland. But these are exceptional breakthroughs. The major long-standing showcase for Mormon dance and drama is the Polynesian Cultural Center in Lai'i, Hawaii. Here, in regular performances each afternoon and evening, the Mormon zest for dance can be seen at its best. A lagoon winds its way through a charming setting of Polynesian huts. And on floating platforms, energetic youth in dress of Fiji, Tonga, or Samoa dance to the pulsating rhythms of rattles and drums. Six Polynesian cultures are portrayed in model villages surrounding the lagoons, and the tourist gets a chance to try his hands and hips at the hula or other dancers, dancing with the assistance of charming youth. In an evening program set in a 2,500-seat auditorium, multiple types of Polynesian dance are smartly choreographed with spectacular lighting effects that rival anything found in the nightclubs of Waikiki. I assume many of you have been there. I would say the bulk. How many have been to Polynesian Cultural Center, or at least half of the audience this morning? All types of dance, however, have not been uniformly accepted by the saints. In the 19th century, the waltz fell under partial ban due to its associations with brothels and barrooms. In the 20th century, the twist was officially condemned as faddish. How then did straight-laced Mormons ever start doing the hula? What made the situation in Hawaii so different? Next section is called Missionaries in the Hula. Mainline missionaries, primarily congregational, had been spreading the gospel in Hawaii since 1820, but their attitude toward native culture was almost completely negative. Heathenish, quote-unquote, dance was abhorrent, especially the hula with its hip-swinging rhythms. It was a form of sympathetic magic. Results were sought through an imitation. Just as the mime of pulling in the fish could help produce the next day's catch, so fertility could be imitated by bodily gyrations. Since orgies sometimes climax these dances, it is understandable why the missionaries were shocked. Their overreaction to a few dances led to the banning of all dance. But the hula did not disappear. It was simply driven underground to the grog shops in harbor towns. When the Mormons arrived in the mid-1880s, they were less shocked by the heathenish dance. Was it because the worst excesses had been abolished and only the harmless forms remained? Or was it because degradation is in the eyes of the beholder? Whatever the case, saints found themselves in a new situation. Rather than attack native culture, they could in fact swing with the backlash that had developed as a protest to the missionaries' puritanical attempts to root out paganism and to ban sensuous dances and impose Western dress. The excessive clothing recommended by mainline missionaries helped increase tuberculosis on the island, and there was a genuine fear of genocide. The birth rate had fallen drastically, and land grabbing was common, for Hawaiians had no concept of real estate ownership. Like the American Indian, the native Hawaiian was becoming an endangered species. Next section, the Native Hawaiian Renaissance. Such concerns prompted King Kalakaua, who reigned 1874 to 1891, to begin a campaign to save his people from cultural imperialism and restore native traditions that had given them their identity. He borrowed a slogan, Hawaii for the Hawaiians, from the masthead of a newspaper published by the infamous Walter Murray Gibson, who had fled to Honolulu after his excommunication by the Mormons and the collapse of his petty Mormon empire on the island of Lanai. Gibson later joined Kalakaua's cabinet and helped the king plan an elaborate coronation ceremony which blended European royal traditions with those of the native of native Hawaii. As a part of the coronation festivities in 1883, the king reintroduced the hula into polite society. Appreciation of dance may be a clue to the natural link that seemed to be forged between the king and the new religion invading the islands, Mormonism. Were the Mormons and the king kindred spirits? Kalakaua may well have sensed such a bond, for he visited the new Mormon colony at Lai'i on several occasions and saw in it an embodiment of the very virtues he was trying to encourage in his subjects. The motto he had chosen for his reign, Ho Holu Lahui, increase the race, dovetailed nicely with the Mormon emphasis on large families. On one occasion, he complimented them specifically on their prolific tendencies, along with their industry, morality, and cooperative spirit. Mormons were quick to exploit this friendship on several occasions when Protestant and Catholic leaders tried to push discriminatory legislation that would bar Mormons from claiming tax exemption or performing marriages. King Kalakaua, prompted by Walter Murray Gibson, intervened on their behalf. Still, there were limits to this friendship. Kalakaua was not about to become a Mormon. The Merry Monarch loved alcohol too dearly and was reputed to be a womanizer. His wife, Queen Kapiolani, however, evidently toyed with the idea of conversion and is reported to have contemplated Mormon baptism. Next section is pride and ancestral heritage. In addition to dance, Kalakaua and the Mormons shared an interest in helping Hawaiians discover or rediscover their ancestral chants, which came close to being lost forever. Mainline missionaries decried them as heathenish recitals of a past that is best forgotten. Mormons, on the other hand, saw the chants as valuable oral genealogies that could help Polynesians trace their ancestry back to Book of Mormon peoples. In searching the Mormon scripture, they discovered the story of a certain Nephite named, how do you pronounce it?
Hagoth.
I didn't think that was quite right. Named Hagoth, who had sailed from America into the Pacific about 55 B.C. With the help of their own genealogies, supplemented by the Book of Mormon, Polynesians could now trace their ancestry back to biblical times through Hagoth, an American Nephite. The mainline scholars were fond of tracing Polynesian origins back to Asian, not American, sources. And they might scoff at such theories, but the Pacific Islanders, rejoicing in their newfound identity, eagerly embraced these promises. Their chants could help them prove they were not unimportant people to be shunted aside by an advancing white civilization, but were instead a branch of Israel, miraculously preserved in the Pacific. Their history didn't begin with the so-called discoveries of Captain Cook. It began with Adam. Now toward a theology of dance. Aboriginal dances, like chants, came to be perceived in a similar way as a part of an Israelite heritage, much diffused and diminished through time and distance, to be sure, but still a matter for pride, not shame. Acceptance of these dances may be related to the high evaluation of the human body found in Mormonism. While traditional Christianity, particularly Protestantism, from which I come, had often separated body and spirit, putting flesh on a lower level, Mormons had done almost the opposite. For Mormons, to have a body is much more important than to be an incorporeal spirit. Only by taking on a tabernacle of flesh and undergoing trials in this material world can spirit beings rise to a higher stage of glory. In fact, God himself so progressed until he now has a body. And, like him, we are to have glorified bodies in the hereafter. Sexuality, then, is never sinful per se. It is the means whereby waiting spirits can come into this physical realm and enter a growth process that angels might well envy. So when pious Protestants of the time were shocked by Mormon dance, Brigham Young could respond, "Every faculty and power of both body and mind is a gift from God. Never say that means used to create and continue healthy action of body and mind are from hell." If anything, dance is more to be acquainted with heaven in the teachings of Brigham Young, and I quote here from the Discourses of Brigham Young, "There is no music in hell." Next section, the gathering place, Lai. All of this helps explain why Mormons have created an institution like the Polynesian Cultural Center where dance predominates and is performed with such gusto. Its location at Laie is due to the concept of gathering place in preparation for the millennium. Here, a little Zion clusters about a majestic Mormon temple built in 1910, the first such temple in the Pacific area. This gleaming white temple serves as a magnet to draw Mormon converts from scattered islands thousands of miles away. Many come here to do temple work, to baptize deceased relatives by proxy, and perform endowment rituals that could bind their family for the eternities. So many of these rituals, as you well know, can be endlessly repeated. Some families migrated to stay, others were simply looking for employment. But by mid-20th century, several thousand settlers were drawn, mainly from Samoa, but also from as far away as Tonga, Fiji, and Tahiti. Each of these groups had brought its own distinctive lifestyles, unique foods, dress, music, and dance. On Saturday mornings, the various island peoples gathered at the shore for a hukilau, Hawaiian term for a fishing festival that involved competitive sports and a huge meal or luau. For entertainment following the meal, one or two groups displayed dances popular on their islands, and this soon became the most popular aspect of the festival, and tourists stopped to see what was going on. It is not hard to imagine how ideas began to fly. Why not charge admission? Each group could perform some dances. Why, we could make handicrafts to sell and teach people. We could even have some model villages for people to visit and call it Polynesia in a day. So began one of the most unique and successful enterprises in the tourist industry, tourism with an educational and religious purpose. Operated in part, large part, by students on work-study grants at the New Mormon College at Lai'i, it has grown to a 42-acre complex of 6-flag amusement park size. In continuous operation for 25 years, the center now draws 1 out of every 4 tourists who visit the islands. It grosses over $30 million a year, most of which is plowed back into operating expenses for the college next door, Brigham Young University's Hawaii campus. The PCC has become Hawaii's number one paid attraction, a startling fact in a state preoccupied with tourism. Next to the last section, the tarnished image. How am I doing on time? But success has produced its own set of problems. When I first visited the PCC, or I'll call it the center, shortly after it opened in 1963, I was impressed with the serious effort made to portray authentic village life. There was a slightly unfinished look about the village then, gravel paths, patches of mud. Now the center is postcard pretty, with well-manicured lawns and paved paths. The huts still look authentic, but the concrete floors, concealed electric lights, weatherproofed roofs, the sprinkler systems, and all disclose the increased commercialization of the enterprise. The villages have always been artificial. No one cooks or sleeps there, and there are no pigs or odors of common third world life. Everything is operated smoothly and efficiently by smiling tourists. Some say it has become an ethnic Disneyland. Planned improvements include a theater with a giant screen spectacular that will rival the Omnivox currently drawing crowds at Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas. But is this progress? I think it's called Emacs is the name of this new form of film. One of the more attractive features of the center is the way students interact with visitors in hands-on demonstrations, making tapa cloth, husking a coconut, or wiggling a hula. The visitors of the future will sit at least part of the time now in a darkened theater watching screen images instead of live actors, removing the experience one step further from reality. Perhaps we tourists are the ones to blame. We like our experiences of foreign culture packaged for easy consumption. We grab a few bargains, snap a few pictures, and go on our way. The saints have been far more persistent. They came as missionaries. They stayed as missionaries. They have been far more successful in Hawaii than elsewhere because of their openness to Polynesian gifts and graces. Mormon missionaries to Hawaii did not isolate themselves in mission compounds, but lived among the people, ate their food, danced their dances. The Polynesian Cultural Center, which they founded, has its weaknesses, but it educates as well as entertains and provides work-study grants for hundreds of college students. Some of them can even dance their way to a diploma. And then my conclusion is called Dancing for the Glory of God. From frontier days to the present, Mormons have pioneered an approach to dance that is strikingly at variance with mainstream religion. Pioneer preacher Peter Cartwright, comes from my state of Illinois, prided himself on interrupting public dances and turning them into prayer meetings. The Mormons, on the other hand, welcome such dances and preface them with prayer. The latter seems a healthier approach, for the natural will surely be one of God's good gifts. If so, even the hula might be danced for the glory of God.
Thank you very much. Now we'll have a few comments by Dale Blair, after which we'll have some time for you to ask any questions or make comments.
The reason my wife was asked to do this was because she was on the Brigham Young University Standards Committee when she was there attending school. I was not on the committee, but I asked her some of the interesting details that might apply to this. And she said that one of the reasons she had been invited was because she talked with, I'm not sure who it was, but someone who was involved with this symposium about editing films to be shown at Brigham Young University. One of the films was The Wrath of Khan, which is a Star Trek sequel. And in that, they wanted to edit out Montalban's exposure of his chest because it looks too bodily and almost smutty, and so they edited some of that out, and of course language and so forth also. But there, the Mormon culture and the institution of the church have kind of an interesting interplay with how to deal with the morality and what might be termed immorality of using the body. How do you what is proper and what is improper? In when my mother was a student at BYU, she recalled Spencer Kimball, then an apostle, who came and spoke to the women about the kinds of dresses they should and should not wear, and it became known as Kimballizing your dress. To take the spaghetti straps or the strapless ones, some people have heard of this, I guess, and put and cover the body more completely. So there is an element or a level of tolerance that is permissible, and there's also that which is not permissible. In going over this paper, I have just some marginal notes that I will comment on.
We're handing these out now.
Okay, yes.
It might be easier to see what I have and what you're reacting to.
Yeah. One of the tensions here that I sensed was the missionaries who have been what I call fossilized in their culture. These would be the non-LDS missionaries, perhaps, who have been fossilized into the assumption that what they are is what all must be, and anything that is at variance with their way of being then is by default sin, and if you must repent of not being like me. Whereas with Mormon missionaries, there is that to some degree, mainly, I guess, with belief and systems of belief. Mormon missionaries are, as a rule, young and impressionable young men and women. And when they go out into the culture, they do a lot of assimilating. It is not rare to find examples of sisters and elders who have gone out and actually become more part of the culture that they were missionary in, which they were missionaries, and not felt at home when they returned. And the adjustment period is a consequence of that. I was a missionary in Ecuador in 1978, and one of the other elders that I worked with said he can't go home. He said, I don't want to go home. I don't feel at home in the United States. This is where I belong. And he has spent most of his life since that time there in Ecuador. That's one example. I'm sure there are a number. Anyway, now with the marginal notes, the meaning of dancing to the first missionaries there, the pre-Mormon missionaries, they of course saw it in its ritualistic and what they called heathenistic form, and it had no meaning to them of acceptable culture. It was not dances that could have been tolerable to them, but this dancing to the Mormon missionaries when they came reified the existence of their, well, reified their the gospel they were teaching, that these people were in fact members of the house of Israel, and as a consequence were talked about in the Book of Mormon and were those to whom the elders had been sent specifically. Down near the end of the first page, Mormons are surprisingly with it. I think that Mormons are with it on a couple of other counts also. There are a number of stories in the folklore of Mormons about the leaders. Of note is J. Golden Kimball, who was known for his wry sense of humor, his cursing, and his imbibing, especially drinking coffee, I guess, but also perhaps occasionally some liquor. Also, recently, jokes about, not about actually, but told by Spencer Kimball. My grandfather was the president of the Idaho Falls Temple up until 1980, and to this day he recalls incidents where President Kimball and Eldon Tanner and President Romney were in the temple with him. As they were walking down the stairs, they could see the First Presidency, President Kimball and his counselors, the pictures of them hanging above some of the stairs. President Kimball looked up at them, shook his head, and said, "Oh, the three blind mice, can you believe it?" My grandmother's house where they stayed, they woke up early in the morning, went to do ceilings and so forth in the temple, and set apart sealers and do whatever else is necessary there. They returned in the afternoon, and my grandmother suggested they have something to eat. President Kimball said, "No, thank you, Jenny. We've really got to do some other things." And President Tanner said, "Well, if it's all right with you, President, I would like to have something to eat." And President Kimball said, "Well, I guess I would too." And he turned to her and said, that's why we have counselors. Things that make the people, especially the leaders, appear human and yet tolerable within the domain of Mormonism, appeal to Mormons. And other examples of this are pranks that Mormons do, especially missionaries. Bert Wilson has a good article, I believe it was published in Sunstone, about the folklore of Mormon missionaries that I could suggest that would give other things that show that Mormons are with it perhaps to a greater extent than the world at large might perceive them to be. Dance as a way of being. I'm just going through and trying to catch some things here. As a way of, as an expression of ritual and expression of a mythic past and history and something to which the Hawaiians, part of their ontology is connected with that dance. Part of being Hawaiian is doing the hula, I suppose. And that then also is the tension here that I feel is between the dancers expressing something that is not acceptable, such as sexuality and so forth, and that being a part of the ritual, and then also which would be abhorrent also to Mormon missionaries, but which had been clearly made less pronounced or something by the time they had gotten there. And then on the other hand, the dance as it expresses the history of the people, which the Mormons craved when they went there. In fact, what the original missionaries, the pre-LDS missionaries, were looking for when they got there was they were looking for heathens to convert. What the Mormon missionaries were looking for when they got there was for members of the tribe of members of one of the tribes of Israel, and each of them found in what they were looking at when they arrived precisely what they were looking for. Whether or not it is historically correct to draw those conclusions, the conclusions were drawn. I have a note here. One of my friends from Ecuador, the Indians in Ecuador had the men never cut their hair, or they always keep their hair long. In order for them to become Mormon missionaries, there was a big question of would they have to cut their hair? Because there are mission standards and standards, general standards of the church saying, and in fact they even have a picture of how Mormon elders must have their hair cut. And some mission presidents have also set guidelines for sister missionaries as well, for hair length and hairstyles. But this would be a denial of the culture of the Indians for an Indian missionary to cut his hair. And it was bantered back and forth in the mission field and said, well, we won't have them as missionaries, full-time missionaries. We'll just use them in the mission field. And at the time I was working there, President Tuttle, Theodore Tuttle, gave the okay to have the missionaries just serve with long hair. And not long after that, word came back from Salt Lake that it was permissible to have them called as full-time missionaries to their own culture with long hair. Now, the fact that it had to go through so many channels in order to have an okay come back that was acceptable to the members, to the leadership of the mission, shows that there is, to some degree, shows the bureaucracy of the church in getting standards approved or getting standards changed. One of the members of the church, one of the former missionaries there, Marcelino Tabangu by name, wanted to come to BYU to study. And, of course, Brigham Young University has standards of hair. It was mentioned here that even sideburns, long sideburns, are not allowed. It's suggested that mustaches are tolerable, but they should not go down below the corner of the mouth. Beards are not tolerated and so forth. And unless you have a particular pathology that would necessitate you having a beard. One of my friends, I don't know to what extent he engineered this, but he was able to get a doctor's signature saying that he was part of his therapy was to grow a beard for his dermatology, and so he was able to have one of the few that got to have one. With Marcelino Tabango at Brigham Young University, he was not allowed to keep his hair. So he said, well, I will then just go to another institution. And it went back through the system, and they said, well, okay, we will make an exception in his case, since it would be a denial of his culture, a culture that, again, we want to preserve to some extent, but to another, on another hand, we also want to engineer it into mainstream Mormonism and make it a part, make it acceptable to visitors in conference when state presidents and so forth come to Salt Lake to attend the general conference. They must they can't be too intolerable. In other words, they probably need to wear shirts. They need to have some elements of that would be intolerable if they did not have them. Also, let's see, there's the public display of affection at Brigham Young University. It's not uncommon to have people in dances chaperoning, and perhaps they'll come up on occasion. And in fact, a story that was told in one of my classes was that a man who had recently married was dancing with his wife at a Brigham Young University function, and he was holding her closely. A chaperone came up and said, excuse me, brother and sister, don't you think you're dancing a little bit too close? And he leaned over and said, well, we just got married. He said, well, then you're not quite close enough. And pushed them back together. On page 7, one of the quotes here is, for Mormons to have a body is much more important than to be an incorporeal spirit. I think that if we look at in The Pearl of Great Price, one of the quotes from there, I'm not sure of the chapter and verse, but it says that the spirit and the body are the soul of man, and that the spirit and body together receive a fullness of joy. Joy is a common term throughout the scriptures, and as it applies and as it relates, as we can see through various equations that are made. For example, in 2 Nephi chapter 2 verse 25 in the Book of Mormon, it says that Adam fell that men might be, and men are, their reason for being is that they might have joy. The reason for being then is joy. Again, in The Pearl of Great Price, it comments about the reason for being, the Lord's reason for being, and it says, this is my work and my glory, to bring to pass the immortality and eternal life of man. The immortality and eternal life of man is the reason for God, and the reason for man, again, is that man might have joy. So immortality, eternal life, and joy are linked through some scriptures in there. And then if we look again at BYU, if you enter the Wilkinson Center there, the main union building of the campus, you can see in bronze on the floor the seal, and in fact all of the seals of Brigham Young University have the motto that says, the glory of God is intelligence. And if we look back at the scripture that I quoted, the glory of God, and this is my work and my glory, to bring to pass the immortality and eternal life of man, the glory of God is intelligence. Intelligence, then, for Mormons, at least through the scriptures, is joy. We have a temple here in Salt Lake, and dotted temples globe now, which is ostensibly for the purpose of getting endowments and for the education of the saints. You can read in the Doctrine and Covenants about the purposes of the temples, but a temple is a place for growing in intelligence. It's a place of renewing and reifying our mythic heritage from Adam on through to the present day and to the end of the earth. This, the temple, being a place of education, being a place of growing in intelligence, and being a place of joy, takes on an interesting meaning when we apply it back into the scriptures, and we look to where it says the body is, your body is a temple. The meaning for Mormons of having the body be a temple thus carries a significance of the body being a place of learning, a place of growing in intelligence and wisdom. And dance and expressions of the body are ways of growing to understand and growing in intelligence and growing in joy and progressing in all ways and means that we have. That's really all that I've got. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Now, do any of you have questions of either Dale Blair or Dr. Quires? Yes.
Bill. I'd like to ask you, have you researched Brigham Young's comments about dancing on the trip to Salt Lake? I recall some negatives.
Yes.
When the McCombie were dancing. So his support of the activity was not an unmixed one.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It seems to me Clayton had some very strong words on that subject.
Yes, there is some. That's one place where I had to tone down the article after I first did it. I had blown it up a little too much, as though dance was almost a kind of a sacrament among the Mormons, and I got called on that by Michael Hicks, who is he here today, written a book on music among the things. It's coming out this year or next year. And he said I had overdone that. So that's why I put in a couple of places a few qualifying things. Most kinds of dances, line dances, square dances, round dances were shunned in part, and restricted in many ways. But there are so many places where Brigham Young, and I do have some pages here from Discourse, gives a very praiseworthy view of dance as a wholesome activity in proper circumstances, where there's no liquor involved, if the dance stops before 12 o'clock at night, if there is a limit of only two round dances. First, well, maybe one, well, okay, you can have two. And there are various articles. David Spitton has one called These Licentious Days, in which he gives some of those limitations. If the riffraff isn't allowed in, certain types of dance were considered obscene, but most dance was accepted. By the way, if we do talk about, as you did in your comments, and your wife's name said here is Doug, Dale, on your comments, if we do comment on the joy of dance and how all of this centers around the temple, which is a place of growth and advancement toward that joy, why not have dance in the temple? And then, of course, well, we don't, but you did at one time. So at Nauvoo, when the temple was completed, there was dance. And then the next week, Brigham Young thought, well, that wasn't quite the thing to do, and he put a stop to it. And then a month later, according to my notes, he brought it in again. So dance was held in the temple with some of the 12 who were participating. So there's an ambivalence there in that early period. And one of my commentators said they even had cheese and cakes and wine at one of those dances in the temple. But dancing did stop in the temple. Yet, in many Protestant churches and Catholic churches today, dance has come back as a liturgical dance. Not the entertainment dance, not the square dance, but as a method of, raising up your souls to dance. And if you've ever seen some of that, it's quite moving. It can be. It's controversial as well. Dance always seems to be on that borderline between, because it's using the body so fully and so openly, between what's acceptable and what isn't.
You're not a Mormon.
No, I'm not.
What sparked your interest in this?
A visit to the Polynesian Cultural Center, I guess. Several visits. Each January, or every other January, I take a group of students out to visit. We study, actually, Oriental religions in Hawaii is what we're doing. nice excuse for getting away out of that terrible weather in January. We go to Hawaii and visit largely Buddhist and Japanese and Chinese temples and places. And, of course, I saw what the Mormons were doing there, and it's amazing, and I got interested in that. But I'm also interested in Mormonism in general, as you know, Bill, quite beyond just this local, this focus on dance. Yes, sir.
Has the dance, the hula, I don't know much about it, has it been sanitized?
A little. In the Mormon...
Originally, it had a very sexual orientation.
Again, as I say in the paper, it may be in the eyes of the beholder. You know, all these things are. What do we make of it? Even the glimpse of a woman's ankle can be a turn-on for some man. And the foot for the Chinese was a turn-on, you know. Just the foot. So it's in our minds, our eyes. And if you watch it, especially at my age and you're getting older, it's just the beauty of the form that you see. It's not necessarily titillating.
I just want to make this comment. I don't know if you knew this, but during the last World War, now you've mentioned the commercial aspect of the Polynesian Cultural Center, but actually the first response was the preservation of the culture.
Yes.
And I had my brother, who was in the last World War, he happened to be a Seabee, and landed in Tonga with the first group of men that went there, saying how that island... Now, some of the missionaries have been there because he said he heard some of the hymns, you know, in the churches. But pure, he said the dances and things were so wonderful and native. And and he said that those boys coming in there raised havoc with the natives. He said they lived what we call a law of consecration, everything in common almost, with the queen and things there. And he said it was a very devastating thing that the war and the boys going into those islands did. He was there 3 years. And so that was a big response in the Polynesian Cultural Center. On the dress standards of the Polynesian Cultural Center, the person who started the Polynesian Cultural Center, the dances, and we were there when it first started, were much more natural. The clothes were more as the natives. The last time I was over there, I was a little disappointed. Maybe it's the church influence or garments or some of those things. I noticed they were much more covered.
They were more covered, too. I didn't comment on that. You're right.
Programmed it at in Hawaii, in Honolulu, also did one in another island, and I'm trying to think which one it was, and we also visited that one, and it was much more like the first one. A comment on Kibble's dress standard. I must be the age of your mother, because I was there when that proclamation came. It was right before a formal dance, and we had strapless formals. And I remember he said, no strapless formals, and I was like, I thought I had a stroke. But it was the funniest dance, because the only one that ended up with the strapless formal was the singer of the orchestra.
There's a comment here. Thank you.
That was one. Thanks for the comments. One was, I think, the greatest amount of Mormon dancing was in the 20s when I was young. And I wondered if you had followed that through when we had our dance. Every year there was a new dance, a new tango, a new waltz to be learned. We had our dance competitions in the ward and the state, and 10,000 couples dancing on salt air. And very, very beautiful and very impressive. I think our dance program has deteriorated from that. I always am amused at the what I call the Aporian attempts of the religious Blue Noses to differentiate historical from sexual dance when the body movements are involved, unless the dancer, of course, is masked and completely covered, which has been mitigated.
Or married, as in your illustration. And and the rule in the last century was there had to be sunlight shining through. So, Blake?
Yeah, Jim, you've made comments about the openness to the culture being a tool, if you will, to successful missionary work. How do you explain the openness to the Polynesian cultures as opposed, I mean, Mormon missionaries go elsewhere and completely obliterate culture. I wore an American business suit 2 years in a culture where an American business suit made were part of the mafia. You know, it was inane. It was totally crazy.
Where was that?
Nail it, Jordan, nail it. And we seem to have a terrible ambivalence.
Yes.
We have a notion of apostasy, and the notion of apostasy is that Catholics went to the various cultures, and instead of teaching them Christianity, they turned Christianity into their own pagan culture as they went there. And so Mormons are perhaps a bit ambivalent about simply accepting a culture. If I were a missionary to Samoa, I would be able to wear shorts and a nice, red shirt. We treat the cultures differently. How do we explain that openness to one culture and the complete closedness to another?
I'll comment on that, but are you speaking on the same issue? Go ahead, I'll let you have the first word.
It isn't necessarily a religious connotation that causes that. I was in the FBI some years ago, and the FBI used to wear suits and a hat. And if you didn't have that uniform on, well, you were out of uniform. And that was all right in New York City. That was all right when you were dealing with white-collar crime. But when you went to Arizona, and you were dressed with a button-down collar and a tie, and everybody else is going around in blue jeans and boots, the idiocy of the whole thing became quite apparent. And that was one of the legacies of John Edgar Hoover. I'm a fan of his, but that was one thing where I thought he was wrong. But one of the things that they finally did was they said that, my gosh, we're not getting our job done by dressing in these outlandish uniforms. And so I would say that it was a kind of a bureaucratic thing, and when bureaucracy begins to get into the matter of dress code, well, you'll end up with all of these somewhat silly aberrations.
I don't think there's any question that the fact that many of the executives for beneficial life insurance were instrumental in setting up the missionary standards turned all missionaries into beneficial life insurance agents.
It also has to do with mission presence. In my mission, the sisters could wear whatever was most effective for them. Many of them dressed as the Indians did and found that not ineffective, and in fact counter to the work, and so they went dressed.
Well, our dress standards are set by a centralized missionary committee now. And if there are exceptions, they have to be approved by the centralized committee. It's a bureaucracy.
One more comment.
I think Mormons, as well as the Protestant missionaries, tend to confuse religion with the puritanical New England dress.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
so what are we taking to these people? Our way of life? The whole bit of cultural imperialism that Blake was referring to. We want to make them look like us and use Kleenex and say please and thank you. And that may not be the essence of the gospel we're trying to teach. I've been told we have just 2 minutes here, so maybe I better try to wind this up. It's always been a problem among all religious groups to what extent they assimilate and try to draw themselves into that culture, and then they can sell out their own faith in that process and no longer have anything to offer. You mentioned too, Dale, the film, the censorship of film, and I just wondered myself as I looked at this last night, what are you folks going to do with The Last Temptations of Christ? You know, that's the... you're not going to see it in Salt Lake City, are you? It's not on in my hometown. It's been banned. Yeah. That's what they say. It's not that good. But it does raise all these issues of who are we as human beings? What was Jesus? Was he, really human? And if he was, he was tempted. And at least the Orthodox Christianity that I come from ought to have no problem with that as a real human being. He could have had temptations. But then even more with Mormons, wasn't Jesus married? Don't most Mormons believe Jesus was married? And yet you're going to have a heck of a time with that film because it carries a little bit far into a marriage and into a second marriage and an adultery in the dream sequence, which isn't the real Jesus. It's his dream that he has from the cross. So I understand there is a program, though, on The Last Temptation of Christ. I think it's scheduled for Friday. It's not in the printed program, but it's in the added material. So we'll all be interested in that. And I think we'll have to stop with that or hand it back to you.